MenaWatch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank.
Welcome to a new episode of MenaTalk. My name is Jasmine Arimi and I'm joined today with A.L. Drawer. He is an active reserve officer, Lieutenant Colonel Reserve in the Israeli Defense Forces and has served for 24 years in different positions in the security and coordination units of the IDF. Today, he serves in the Golan Heights. And many people know him as the founder and commander of the Good Neighbor Project, a humanitarian project that provided medical treatment, food, fuel, and other supplies to Syrian civilians during the war. We are very happy to have you with us today. Please welcome A.L. Drawer.
Hey, Jasmine. So thank you very much to you and the audience. Thank you for the opportunity to share my voice and my message. I do believe that what you're going to hear is very unique. Probably most of the audience didn't hear about Operation Good Neighbor, one of the biggest humanitarian operation has been made by in the world ever, and I do believe that if anyone heard about that, probably he will know much more details. So for me, it's an honor, and I really appreciate being hosted here with you, and we're going to have a very pleasant interview, I hope.
In your own words, what was the main goal of Operation Good Neighbor, and how and why did you decide to write a book about it?
So Operation Good Neighbor started in 2016. The days were the days of the Syrian civil war, started a little bit earlier. Israel realized back at 2013 that as Jews, we cannot stand behind the security fence while people are dying, and they were massacred by the former government. We saw it in our own eyes. I think that the world saw it. Infrastructure has been bombed. People were dying, they were suffering without any medical assistance, and we realized that we can give them a hand. We realized that we don't have the opportunity like the rest of the world to close our eyes. We're the Israelis, we're the Jewish people. We suffered years ago when the war disignored from our problems back in the 40s, and we said that we cannot allow that. This was the thought behind. The second thought, which was connected, was that Syrians were educated to hate us for years. This is the stories that we heard from them. And we realized that if they will, for the first time in history, because Syrians never met Israelis, when they will realize that we are not come to conquer the land like they heard, that we are here and we are willing to risk our lives in order to give them life, in order to give them aid, we realize that this unique opportunity, we cannot miss it, and we can change and build bridges between the Israelis people and the Syrians people. I remind you that nobody knew back at those times what will be the future of Syria. This was the initial thought, the first thought behind that. We never assumed that the operation will be such a huge and will influence so many people on the other side. When I retired, I realized that this story must be written because it's an historic story. So it took me like 3 years to publish it in the Hebrew, and then another 2 years to publish it in English. And hopefully also it will be published during the next year also in Germany, because I do believe that is a story that people should know.
Yeah, we are looking forward to it. Can you describe the mission and what a typical mission also looked like?
So the mission was very simple, to provide humanitarian aid to the other side, to the Syrians. It took us time to build a network of civilians on the other side, people that were risking their lives, they were willing to risk their lives to collaborate with the Israelis. You know, in the Arabic world, sometimes if you are called, in Arabic we say it amil, it means like collaborator. It's not a nice word, and you probably can risk your life. So it took us time, because the time we were using to build trust between us and them, in order to make them the opportunity to reach the border and to trust us that we can deliver humanitarian aid. So after we build this net and after we learned what they need, and I think it's an important message. When you're doing humanitarian aid, sometimes you give what you have, but it's not necessarily what the other side need. I was insisting to address very carefully what the real needs are. And after we realized that, we succeeded to bring it to our unit. Then it was a lot of work, logistic work, very hard work, just to put tons of equipment on trucks at our headquarters, then going to the field. On the field, it was a different story. It's not to provide, humanitarian aid in a place that, was hit by a storm. It was to provide humanitarian aid on a hostile area. At that time, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Hezbollah were on the other side of the fence. They were enemies, and we were coming closer to them. So it was to risk the life and to do all the operational processes in order to bring this supply to the other side of the fence. I will mention on the fence itself, not like stories that has been told. We never entered the cities and the villages of Syria. We're on the border. We put it on the other side of the border of the fence, and we ask our colleagues to come and to take it in order that they will be able to provide it. So although the act itself was sometimes only 45 to 60 minutes, it took sometimes hours before to plan everything, to address everything, to supply everything, to get the sponsorship from the NGOs that were working with us, and then to go with all the operational system in order to provide it to the other side. And I will mention it again and again. It was on a hostile area. It wasn't on a clear area. So we had to take a lot of terms under calculation in order that our soldiers will come back alive.
Can you share one specific story that shows the challenges your team faced during the project and during all this?
Of course, there was plenty of it. But two scenarios, as commander, that I was needed to give a very quick answer. First of all, you're making all the organization, you're prepare all the preparation, you're ready, you're coming to the spot, and then you've been informed that there is fog. Fog means that I cannot use my observation abilities to see what is going on the other side, to understand that the enemy is not taking advantage. Now, it wasn't a secret operation. It means that if the other side want to hit us, it can collect intelligence, and probably you don't need to be a sophisticated intelligence officer in order to conduct a terror activity against me and my soldiers. When you have a fog, it's a huge disadvantage in my language, my military language. And now you need to get a decision. Are you doing that or not? Are you taking double risk? Can the soldiers trust you? Can the other commanders trust you? But you know that you promise it to the Syrians. You know that if you will not provide them, a baby will not get a baby formula, for example. So you are making a lot of other calculations, and you have on the micro tactic level to address the situation and to give first-hand solutions and to change on a field how the preparation. So this goes to the operational level. However, I will give you one more example of a problem that hit us or challenges that hit us. For example, we provided flour to the other side, to the Syrians. They make with this bread. Now, it was going with huge pallets, 1 ton. It means that 25 kilogram in each bucket, 40 of them. Now, just imagine that when you are on the border and you are now have the forklift that taking to the other side, it hit it and the pallet is breaking and all the bags are falling down. What you will do? Any minute on the on that land is a risk. The solution, we're not leaving it, we will take it by our hands. It means that now you have more challenges to provide this bread, more time, you need to take more information in calculation, but if you will not provide it, people will not eat bread the day after. So this is just small examples of the challenges that we're facing day by day. It was every day we had our challenges and we need to bring very quick solutions.
How did you balance humanitarian work and security concerns for the soldiers you're with? I think there needs to be like a balance between the soldiers and the civilians. How did you manage that?
We realize that it's not a simple mission. We realize that it's a risky mission. Our soldiers realized that. Our soldiers understood that from their point of view, because a soldier in his mind is doing a mission in order to defend its country. Humanitarian aid, it's not a typical military work. When you explain them that the meaning of that mission is to, first of all, save people on the other hand, it's on the emotional side of the soldier. And when he saw the children coming from Syria, he immediately remembered that he, in his home, he has a little brother or sister that looks like this Syrian young boy. But on the operational side, you explain him exactly like I explained in the beginning, that we want to show them that we are not the enemy. We want to show them that they can trust us. It means that it helps us to secure the border, because if there is less hostility on the other side, probably there is less risks. It means that we reach the same consequences, but without using military power, but using the soft power. And when you explain to soldiers why it's important to provide fuel or bread or medicine, you see that they realized. And like I said before, when they experience the hundreds of moments with people that living only 500 meters from them, and they realized how they were living and how privileged it was for us to help those people, well, you see them smiling and you understood that they are willing to put their lives on a risk for humanity and for the state of Israel. It goes hand by hand.
It's now in the Gaza conflict, often like the armed groups are taking all the humanitarian aid. And how did you make sure that the aid really reached the civilians and not the armed groups there?
So I would just mention that, first of all, there is a huge difference between what happened in Syria and Gaza. In Gaza, the armed groups are Hamas, are the government. In Syria, they weren't the government. Honestly, I didn't know, or I couldn't have 100% to control if one of the armed group got some bread or some medicine. However, we could have monitored, and we did this very carefully, who is getting the aid and how he provide aid. I can give you, and it's written in my book, that were two cases. While we realized that our colleagues, so-called colleagues, got an aid, the mission was to give it to the people of the village, and we got by third side that they are sending it in order to earn money. The message was very, very powerful. Immediately we cut the aid. And we said to other people in the village that it is not because we don't want to help you. It's because you put a corrupt person that hit you at the end of the day. I think that it was a very powerful message, because after it hit two times and they changed the POCs, the people of contact, we didn't see that again. So like I said, you don't have 100% of insurance in those cases. However, we could have monitored. I think that the other side, the Syrians, realized that we have a lot of tools to realize if they are cheating or not cheating. And as much as I know, the humanitarian aid reached to the people that the end of the day were needed. How we did it? For example, we had a project in which 25 children accompanied by the mothers entered Israel every week to get medical treatment. Now, when you're sitting with the old Chaja, with the old lady, and you're sitting with her and talking with her, you can hear a lot of the voices, whether the village got the humanitarian aid, whether in the clinic in the village there is medicines, because we send medicines. So I had a lot of people to ask directly the question that were interested me. So I do believe that we succeeded to do a good job again. Probably it wasn't 100% guarantees, but I think that we're close to that.
Some critics say that humanitarian work by the military can also serve political or strategic goals. How would you respond to that?
I'm not embarrassed or shy to say political goals. I think it's far too much. But strategic goals, like I told you, one of our understanding was that we can change the environment between Israelis and Syrians. It's a strategic goal, of course, made by the humanitarian aid. I will ask you or any other person, we could have sit behind the fence and let them die. So what is more important? Of course, we are not an NGO. We are not a humanitarian organization. By the way, also humanitarian organization, like probably you understand, have their own political or strategic point of views. So it goes hand by with hand. But like I said, I do believe that the understanding, or if you were trying to dig and to find what was the strategic goal, yes, the strategic goal was to build bridges between people, to connect directly, not indirectly, not through politicians, not through media. I met thousands of Syrians. It wasn't any other opportunity for Israeli or for Syrians to meet so many Israelis or so many Syrians. So I do believe that this strategic goal was very important, and it wasn't like we are going to take advantage on that situation. The situation happened, the humanitarian aid happened, the understanding that we through that can build bridges and we will have a win-win situation for both of the sides, because also the Syrians realize who are the Israelis.
How did you personally deal with the fact that the IDF is a military force? You are working there, of course, while at the same time providing medical care and humanitarian food. Like, how does it resolve your kind of work? Can you explain a little bit more so that listeners maybe understand also the work of the IDF a little bit better?
I'm not a warrior in the IDF. I was serving in a unit called the COGAT, the Coordination of Government Activities in Territories in Judea and Samaria and Gaza. And most of my days, what I have made in my military, long, long military career, what I've done was to coordinate with people living on the other side, whether with Palestinians in Gaza, Hebron, Bethlehem, Tulkarem, Kalkilia, all over Judea and Samaria, or in Syria. The IDF is doing humanitarian aid, I would mention, all over the world. You will find the IDF rescue teams on Haiti and Tahiti when they had the earthquake. You will find them in Turkey. You will find them in Africa while a village was destroyed from explosions of ammunition. IDF reached for the first. So the IDF sending is, but by the way, when it was the war between Russia and Ukraine, the first army that built a field clinic at Poland on the border was IDF. So the IDF provide aid all over the world. I do believe that it go back to our values. For me as a person that did it dedicate my military career for humanitarian aid, for building bridges with the other side, it was very simple. The understanding that with that, if you are using it correctly, because later on maybe we'll talk about what has happened when NGO or someone use humanitarian aid not in a proper way, but when you use it correctly, and I will say that this was the huge difference between what happened in Syria to what happened in Gaza, when you use it correctly, I think miracle can happen, bridges can be built. So I'm not a person that need to be convinced. Yes, my one of the missions that I took for myself is to explain it, not to convince, to explain it to the soldiers. Why, if a warrior in the IDF is doing that mission, I can tell you that their commanders said that they become better human beings. And by the way, one of our roles of the IDF, and maybe it sounds strange, but you know, we are taking those children when they are 18, they are going out when they are 21, is to make them better civilians. And I think that when they saw the poverty on the other side and realized that they can raise their hand and help the other side, people living on the other side, they become better human beings, better civilians, and better warriors, because they now realize for what they are fighting for, which is a very, very important lesson for a lesson for the soul of a warrior. So for me, it was very easy. Happily, I can say that for 99% of the soldiers and commanders that I meet, and we were collaborating with thousands of soldiers from a lot of different units, 99% of them, it was very easy to explain them why we're doing that mission.
Would you say that political impact with the Operation Good Neighbor had a success during the two countries, Syria and Israel?
With the Assad government, of course, it wasn't a good relationship. Assad called to destroy the state of Israel. He know that we are the enemies. He was the enemy. And for sure, he didn't give us credit of saving the life of his own people, although they were Syrians, the same people that he was murdered. But when everything has been changed in Syria, a year and a half ago. So today, for example, there is a minister in the administration of Ashara, which was the manager of one of the most important organizations, worked in Syria, not collaborating with the IDF. They were the rescue teams in Syria. However, in our last operation, we saved the lives of over than 400 of those people. He was the CEO. He knows that because of me and my soldiers, over 400 of his people are alive today. And he is sitting now on when there is the government meetings. He's sitting there. A lot of Syrians living next to the border and a little bit more far away from the border knows that they are living because of Israel. A lot of Syrians living outside Syria, including in Germany, knows that they are living, or the friends or the family members are living, thanks to the state of Israel. So I do believe that we had some huge advantage for the future from that operation, although it ended in 2018. And I desire, because today the situation is unclear between Israel and Syria, but my passion is that when one time it will be talks, Operation Good Neighbor will be a great point to start this dialogue, because we save you and we don't hate you. Show us that you respect us and we can do great things together.
To some shadow points, like countries, Russia, Iran, for example, how did they react to the project?
Both of them didn't appreciate the project, I'd say like that. They were the allies of the Assad government, and from their point of view, because Israel took a side and helped the side that fight against Assad, so it wasn't goes well with their programs. We saw that the Russians are sending messages for the Israeli authorities about our actions with Iran. Iran, well, we don't have any contact with them, but we realized that the Iranians trying sometimes to hit our operation by their proxies, etc. But it goes back to the former question and Iran. Now, in those days, we have a mutual enemy. We and the Syrian government. Those are the Shiites, extremist Shiites of Iraq, and the Shiite militias of Iran, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And we saw that during that war, Assad sent his troops to close the borders with Lebanon and to Iraq, not to give them the opportunity to take advantage on the Syrian land to attack Israel. So it goes back also to what we have done before. They know that Israel saved those their people because they were Sunnis, and we helped the Sunnis population. And now they are closing it, you know, the relationship between Ashara and Sunni to a Shiite, which were killing him and his, or killing his people. So they do not appreciate much each other. But I will add that the understanding that Israel were the people that stand alongside his own people, I think that it is also very important for the understanding that he do not want to give them opportunity to hit us. So everything is connected at the end of the day. I think that the impact of what we have done, we can see it even today. You're hearing people from outside Syria that saying, I'm alive thanks to Israel. I still have, for example, I see the surgery that an Israeli doctor did. He saved my life. So again, this is not something that can be forgotten very quickly.
Did the actions change your work somehow from Iran or Russia? Did you had to change a lot of things in your project?
So like I said, it was like a part of the challenges. The fog is a challenge. Iran is a challenge. Hezbollah is a challenge. When the you don't get the forklift, it's a challenge. I had 3 years full of challenges. Again, this is why I wrote the book, because I do believe that managers, and yes, I'm a military person, but and this was a military operation, but I do believe that people that will read the book and take a look how I chose to call it, Embracing the Enemy, but people that will read it will find not just a very romantic story about Israel and Syria relations, they will find literally tools to how you build trust, how you work on an uncertainty. They will find tools how to build collaboration. They will understand why failure sometimes is something that is necessary, and how you're facing a failure. Everything is with examples from what we have. So plenty of challenges. Iran was a challenge. Turkey was a challenge. I can tell you that I had bigger challenges because, again, this is something very strategic. We knew that they are operating to block us. But again, I will leave it for the politicians this on the field. Of course, if I knew that there is intel about a team that trying to hit me, of course we had to see how we are doing it on the other side. But like I said, everything in this book was mentioned that people will not just read a nice story, but I do believe, because it was like, I can call it a startup, a national startup. Yes, I didn't earn money for that, but it was some kind of startup. I do believe that people can learn from this experience. And you ask me why I wrote it, because it's a story that should be told, but there is plenty of lessons about leadership, about the meaning of how you are taking the soldiers behind you, how you... So I think, like I said before, it goes with the message of the book, and with the addition of course, the very emotional examples of what we experienced on the field.
Who did you write a book for? Is it like a wider audience, or did you just put it out for military peoples? What can we expect?
I do believe that anyone and everyone, excuse me, can find something in this book that he can say, wow, it helps me. Because some people will read the chapter about how I describe the situation of as a human being, as a father of three children, meeting a Syrian child in the middle of the winter. He's coming barefoot on the middle of the night. He's crying. It can break your heart. And one would say, wow, it's amazing to see that a Syrian girl is drawing the flag of Israel and mentioning your name on it. And others will say, wow, we so appreciate the fact that you realized how to build trust with the other side. So I think that everyone can be connected. Israelis, Jews, non-Jews, Syrians, people from Germany. I think that everyone can find this book something that he will say, okay, I want to read this chapter. It talks to me.
What are the most important lessons from the book and from the project that other countries and militaries could take from the experience?
I think that important lessons are know the culture and the tradition of the person that you are talking with or communicating with. I'm from Israel, you are from Germany. We are living in, although we are have the Western education and we believe in democracy and liberal values, probably there is huge difference between us. And if we want to have a company together, I need to understand how you are thinking and what led you, and you need to understand it's about me. So I do believe that first to understand who is standing on the other side, what is his limitation, what is the forces that forcing him to do something. Because you can, for example, again, if it goes to business, I don't know, you don't have many investors. So I need to address and to learn everything from culture to limits that you have. So this is one thing that's very important. I will give you an example from my story. For example, we know that Muslims have two big holidays, the Eid al-Adha and Eid al-Fitr. And we provide them in those holidays meat. Why? Because on their tradition, in those holidays, they are eating a lot of meat. In Syria, they don't have the ability to buy meat. It was very expensive. While I was delivering the meat during these holidays, it tells them that it's not just I want to give you aid, because I could have gave them flour or, I don't know, corn. It also says that I know your tradition, I know your culture, I took a time to learn it, and I appreciate it, and I want to give it to you. I think that the bottom line or the untold message is we are friends. I took time to give something that I know that it is important for you. So this is just one example. I do believe that this is two main and very powerful and important messages. By the way, I think that the third message, and it goes to managers, leaders, is to know how to put the red lines. Red lines is a part of building trust. I'm writing today, in these days, a PhD about collaboration, inter-organizational collaboration in crisis. And one of the chapters is trust. Red lines is an important part of building trust. It means that I can trust you, I can give you, however, there is rules. And if you are breaking it, even if it will not be comfortable to me, we will not work together. I told you about the two guys that I found that were cheating on us. There was plenty of other examples, not with Syrians, with one of the NGOs that work with me, and break the agreement between us, the informal agreement. And I decided to take a decision to take him out of this project, although I was needed his money very much, because this is a red line. And I do believe that is a very powerful message for leaders, for managers. You cannot close your eyes. You cannot blink. If you are doing that, something will be something wrong will happen to your company or to the organization that you are leading. So I do believe that this is three maybe tactical operative lessons for the community who is leading, whether it's in business, whether in the industry, managers. As managers, well, we are, most of us are the same. We have different challenges, but we have the same understanding or the same system that we need to lead. And this is how you're trying to lead and to build it.
And do you think that other conflict zones could work also, like the project Operation Good Neighbor?
I believe so. But like I gave a hint like 20 minutes ago about, and I spoke about Gaza, I do believe that humanitarian aid is a huge power, especially when you are reaching to zones suffered from crisis, any kind of crisis, by the way. It can be a storm, earthquake, or a war. I think that war is even more extreme. If you are not using it for the right, you can get exactly the negative, the opposite effect. I will give an example about Gaza. For years, the UN, an organization called the UNERA, was working in Gaza, selling to anyone that this is a humanitarian aid. Eventually, we realized that they were terror supporters. They used this humanitarian aid in order to build their power on Gaza, and they use it against civilians. I'm not talking about Israel in this issue, because if you are living in Gaza and you need the flour or the water or the fuel, and it is given by this organization, well, whether you will obey them or not. If you will criticize, you will not get them. This is a bad influence about humanitarian aid. So I do believe that the humanitarian aid is something important. I do believe that organization should understand how to work. And I will say, in areas, for example, like Gaza or maybe in Lebanon in these days, it might give the power to the opposite, to the people that you don't want, that they will control. In Syria, what was so important, that it was a vacuum. You didn't have the government. While the government, like in Gaza, taking advantage on this resource, you are building it. And they can use it not for the appropriate ways. So I do believe that it is a model that we should embrace, but we have to think carefully how to use it.
So finally, in one sentence, what should international humanitarian organizations, NGOs, could learn from your experience? Because we have the problem, we have like a lot of reports that are saying that armed groups are taking humanitarian aid supplies. What could you learn from the experience from the project about that?
So like I said, I think that humanitarian aid, its mission is to provide aid, but it needs to understand what is the situation on the ground in order not to give aid that will go to the armed group or to people that will use it for corruption. By the way, you're saying about armed group, I also concern from corruption. You know, if I'm a corrupted person taking this food and getting a lot of money, I can build a kingdom from that. So maybe I don't have an armed group, but I will, at the end of the day, I will be the man with the research, with the man with the power. So I do believe that an organization, when they are entering a field that needed humanitarian aid, they had to address it and they had to monitor it. And from time to time, like I did, they need to cut it, because people thinking that to give it, it's like, okay, I'm delivering it and we did it and it's good for us. No, sometimes you are creating a negative influence at the area that you have came. So yes, you need to put your research in order to understand what is going on. And if you realize, for example, that you are giving humanitarian aid to civilians and it has been hijacked for corruption or for military group, stop doing it, for example, or trying to build a mechanism that will give you the ability not to do that. Again, there is plenty of tactics. I don't know, bring like people that can secure those areas, because you know that people in need, they can be sometimes even brutal because they're fighting for your life, for their lives. So you have to secure it, because the consequences of bad use of this humanitarian aid might be even bigger than if it wasn't been delivered. And I think that this is not is what going on in a lot of places. Again, as an Israeli, I can give you the examples about what is going on here in the Middle East, but I'm sure that it is happening in other places in the world.
I just wanted to come to an end. Is there anything else you would like to say to the audience?
I hope that they will have interested in hearing this podcast and then to read what we have done and to address more and more. I think that the humanitarian aid field is important field. I think that the relationship between Israel and Syria is very interesting, and I hope that I succeeded to give some teasers to people that want to address a little bit more about these two frames. For me, it was a great honor to be interviewed, and I hope that this message will be shared and people will be able to hear it.
We will also link to your book so that everyone can also read it if you like, in English as well for now. And thank you and the audience for watching this episode of MENA Talk for your time. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share also in the social media world and follow MENA Watch for more interviews about the Middle East. And my name is Jasmine Arimi. Thank you for being with us and see you next time.
MENA Watch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank. Besuchen Sie auch unsere Website. Dort finden Sie täglich neue aktuelle Berichte und ausführliche, wissenschaftlich fundierte Hintergrundanalysen zur Geschichte und Gegenwart der MENA-Region.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.